So it seems that Psalm 22 was on Christ's mind when he was on the cross. And, you know, we get that from the opening words, my God, why have you forsaken me? But it's also interesting that the psalm ends in this note of trust and confidence, what Bonnie just read. So then the question is, you know, what really is on Christ's mind at this point? My God, why have you forsaken me? That seems to be pivotal, obviously. And what element of trust was there in confidence that something would happen beyond that? Psalm suggests there was. So we don't know that answer, so we think about that. We've been looking through the Gospel of Mark the last while here at the church, and so we continue on with that in this unit, Mark 15, 21 to 39 today, thinking of Simon of Cyrene. And we'll say more about him as the pivotal character in our reflection today. But we note from Gospel of Mark that very early in the Gospel, the religious establishment of the day decides that they want to eradicate Christ. So here we see it in Mark chapter 3, verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians. The Pharisees are religious establishment. The Herodians are political followers of King Herod. Conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. These groups do not even usually talk. But together they plan Christ's death because they are so afraid of him, really. They are afraid that he will upset, you know, the apple cart, if you like. And they will do whatever it takes to silence him. And so you see the words, they want to destroy him. So the plan in the Gospels to eradicate Christ happens very early. And so here we are now in chapter 15, and the plan is coming to fruition. But they've been thinking about this for quite a while. The issue is, how do we pull it off? So there's a lot of political intrigue. You know, and our world is full of this stuff today. It happens all over the planet. Political intrigue. How do we silence? Putin has made an art of it. How do you go about silencing your enemies? Master at that. But it has a long history. And so we begin then with our text, thinking again of Simon of Cyrene. They compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Then they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots to decide what each should take. Note, that sounds very much like Psalm 22. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two bandits, one on his right and one on his left. So that's how the Gospel of Mark portrays. So the way it worked with Roman crucifixion, and remember, a Roman citizen could not be crucified. So it was considered so horrific that if you were a Roman citizen, no matter what you did, you're not getting crucified. But here we go, this is happening. So Jesus is carrying the cross beam of his cross, and because we know from previous stories that he has been beaten terribly, and obviously he would be very weak. The crossbeam, the individual would carry it, he falls under its weight. That makes sense. So crucifixion happened outside the city of Jerusalem. So they're on the way out, and he stumbles. And so the Roman centurion, who's in charge of the whole thing, right? He's in charge of up to 200 soldiers. So he's not just a soldier, he's a guy in charge. He sees what's happening, and he looks around, and he grabs someone who's kind of big and strong and says, "Hey, you." And they compel him to carry the crossbeam. So that's the picture that's going on. They're on the way out of town to this hill called Golgotha, and Simon just happens to be coming in. So Simon of Cyrene. Cyrene is modern-day Libya. Libya, Cyrene, was North Africa. And so probably Simon was a follower, proselyte of Judaism. Maybe he's there for the Passover festival. So he's maybe made a trip, or maybe he lives in the area, whatever. He comes in from out of town just at that moment. Christ falls. Simon comes in, and they have that moment. Interesting. Is that just by luck? How does that happen? Simon of Cyrene, he's the one who's chosen. So Christ has already been beaten terribly, so there's the blood of Christ is on the cross, right? It would have to be. So Simon picks up the cross, he puts it on his shoulders. The blood of Christ is already on the cross, the wooden beam. I bet you Simon looked right in the eyes of Christ. Christ looks in his eyes. This is one act, if you like, of kindness, right? One burden that Jesus doesn't have to carry all the way to the cross. This chap is going to help him. He may be compelled, obviously he was, but he still helps him. So I think what's kind of interesting is that this is a moment. This is an opportunity for Simon. This is his chance to meet Christ. This is his moment. So what does he do with his moment? I mean, obviously he carries the cross, but what does he really do with the moment? He meets Jesus. How does it change his life? The suggestion is, because the two individuals, his sons, are noted and named, is that he does indeed become a follower. Because by the early church, they're known. And not only, we'll look later at a text from Romans, not only them, but their mother, who was very dear even to Paul. So he says, "She's like a mother to me." So it seems that something significant happened in that event, just that moment. And so I think, really, you know, that's something for us as well. We just pause at that point. Like, when is our moment with Jesus? I believe that Jesus shows up to everybody. Everybody will have a moment. You will have an opportunity for a moment. Maybe you've already had your moment. Maybe you haven't. When does Jesus show up in your life? I ask my students, when did Jesus break into your family tree? Who became the first follower of Christ in your family? Maybe you don't even know. Maybe it's a generation before, maybe it's two or three generations before that. When did Christ show up in your family? Maybe you're the first one. Maybe you're here this morning and no one has, and maybe you haven't either. So when does Jesus show up? And then what do we do with that moment? That's a key piece, I think. What do we do with that moment? Because in many ways, everything turns on that. Everything turns. We say yes, we say no. We open our hearts, we open our minds. We close our hearts, we close our minds. Paul has that interesting phrase, open the eyes of my heart. I pray that the eyes of your heart will be opened. Well, your heart has no eyes, right? What does that mean? Open the eyes of your heart. It means to have a soft heart, to have a pliable heart, not to have a hard heart. So easy to have a hard heart. Pharaoh had a hard heart. Didn't matter what Moses was doing, incredible miracles, but through God in front of Pharaoh. Like, great miracles. Anybody else would be blown away. And the guy looks at it and it means zip. Diddly squat. See, that's a hard heart. And we can become like that. We can become so in tune with our culture that things spiritual just don't even touch us. Bounce right off our shields. So when are we alone with Jesus? It will happen. Believe me, it will happen. How do we respond? I remember my first time. I was only about 5 or 6. And I was in my bed. And my brother was at some youth event. He was older than I was. Much older than I was, by the way. If you see him, his hair is very gray. He's not tinting it like I tint mine. Anyway, he's out late. And My mom was quite a character in the early days, and she's very upset about all of this. Where is he? Where? Jimmy, where is he? Where is he? Talking to her husband. And I'm praying like crazy, saying, Lord, 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 help Earl come home safely. There must be something up. Bum, 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 bum. No kidding, I was really worked up, crazy. And then all of a sudden, no kidding, I just felt peace pour over me, saying, it will be okay. Honestly, a voice, Alan, it will be okay. I mean, I didn't know anything beyond that. And sure enough, Earl came in not a whole lot later. That was the first time for me, a real touch. Peculiar. But God works in his own way in all of our lives. You know, you have your story. You have your story too, right? Others were looking still forward to it, but Jesus will show up. At the end of that first unit, Jesus is crucified, and they crucified him. In Greek, it's just one word. And they crucified him. Boom. Mark 15 is used over and over and over. With a sign over his head, the King of the Jews. People who were crucified in the end, the crime they supposedly had committed was put over their heads. So this is his crime, the King of the Jews. There's some irony to this, right? The Gospel of Mark is full of irony. So the crucifixion. Jesus is crucified. We'll see the timeline in a moment, at 9 in the morning. So he's not dead yet, right? He's crucified. He's on the cross. At 12 o'clock, darkness covers the entire region. Dark. Noon. It's like an eclipse coming up. And then at 3 o'clock, he finally expires. So he's on the cross at this point. We carry on. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha! You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." Full of irony here. In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes. So this is the religious establishment. This shows how angry they were. Why would they do that? We're also mocking him amongst themselves and saying, he saved others, he cannot save himself. Like, they're mocking him. Like, what's the point of that? But that shows how much they hate him. Let the Messiah, more mocking, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now so that we may see and believe. And even those who were crucified with him also taunted him. So, Psalm 22, those words carry on. Jesus' loneliness. Interesting, in the Gospel of Mark, no one, not even his mom, is at the foot of the cross. No one. The women are there farther off, but no one is surrounding him. No one, no friends. No disciples, He's on his own. We sang that song where depression overcomes somebody, right? But loneliness can also overcome somebody. Our society is full of loneliness, desperate with loneliness. Jesus is completely alone, and the text emphasizes his humiliation. You know, just mocking, berating him, laughing at him. This is Jesus' experience. If you've ever been mocked and laughed at, you know it's not a very nice thing, is it? This is what Jesus is experiencing. To the point where they're saying, come down from the cross. Now, this is an important point. Come down from the cross, and then we will believe you. So as the Son of God, now, you know, it's always, what does Jesus experience in his humanity? What does he experience in his divinity, right? There's always that tension. But in his divinity, he could potentially come down from the cross, right? But the point of it is he does not, because if he did, then there's a limit to his love. It's like he's saying, okay, I will be mocked and bugged and berated, blah, 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 blah. But when it finally comes down to me, if you push me all the way to the end, I'm coming down and I'm going to get you guys. But he doesn't. And so for Mark's point, there's a point behind that. The point is he goes completely all the way for you and me. There is no limit to the love of Christ. There is no limit. He's pushed to the very, very, very end. Come down, and then we will believe you. But he doesn't. And so the good news of that is he loves you to that degree. He loves me. No matter how we push him to the end, he loves us. He loves you. He loves me. He's demonstrated that all the way to the end. So, you know, there is no limitation to Jesus' love, and that's the beauty of it, right? In spite of all the crap you've done in your life, all the crap I've done in my life, Jesus loves us all the way to the end, and that's very important to see. Mark's making a point here. He phrases it this way in early verse, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Didn't come to be served, but to serve. And Jesus identifies with us. This is the other point here. He is in solidarity with us. In our suffering, in our pain, he identifies with us. I shared on Wednesday night, we had the prayer meeting here. When I was walking through the church at the back here, I looked out the window one day, and there was a woman who was going through our garbage, the church's garbage. And she was going through it and collecting food. So there was macaroni that was in the garbage. And she's grabbing it, grabbing this, and eating it. And I'm thinking, wow, what kind of pain and hurt has happened in an individual's life for this? And of course, this happens all around the planet. So does Jesus identify with us in that kind of pain and hurt in solidarity? The story is yes. Of course, Jesus reached out to the desperately poor and hurt and sick. That was much of his ministry, right? Why? Because they're the ones who are open. They're the ones who are saying, yeah, I need help. The religious cities, Jerusalem had terraced homes. There was a 1% in Jerusalem in the day of Christ. They were living very nicely, and so they were in other Roman cities. You can go and visit these terraced grand homes that you would see on the bridle path here in Toronto. They had them. So Jesus identifies with us in your pain, my pain, your loneliness, my loneliness, your grief, my grief, your sadness. Jesus knows it all. He's not other than that. He is with us in that. He is our brother, is he not? That's what the scriptures call him. So Jesus identifies with us. His loneliness. Third part, when it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. At 3:00, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lima sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22, verse 1. And when some of the bystanders heard it, they said, listen, he is calling for Elijah, because one of those words sounds sort of like Elijah. And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a stick and gave it to him, drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come down, take him down. It's interesting, they offer him wine. And the wine was a bit of a sedative. That was the whole idea. Take away your pain a little bit. Jesus says, no. He doesn't want any sedative. He wants to experience, he's going to experience the whole thing. I've read other stories, and I hope one day I might be able to do it, and that is, when you are dying, do you want to be phased out? I've mentioned this before. Somebody gives you a needle, and you go into la-la land, and then you die by going into la-la land. Is that how you want to die? Well, if I was in a lot of pain, I might choose la-la land. I might. But I'd rather, really, not. I'd rather be alert and be able to be with the ones who are around me who love me. And also, so that I'd be alert when I make my next phase. When I step into the next phase, I'd like to be alert and not in la-la land. Jesus decides here, no, I won't take it. And I think part of it is because of his own desire to, not to be sadistic, but he wants to be attentive to this experience. So he says no. Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Interesting, symbolic here, from top to bottom. And now when the centurion, who's in charge of 200 soldiers, who stood facing him, saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was God's son. That's how this unit ends. Then we'll come back to Simon. So Jesus' death, there's the timeline. 9 a.m, early in the morning, Good Friday morning, 9, what do we got? 10 to 11. 9. At noon, darkness covers the whole land for 3 hours. Something strange going on. And at 3 p.m, he cries out his last breath and finally expires. Psalm 22, that's the timeline. So the death is marked by 3 events. 1, there's this loud shout. Interesting, even on that, if you've been crucified for 6 hours, it's interesting he has the energy to create a loud shout. Abba! How do you do that? When everything is falling apart. He manages to do it. And the curtain of the temple is symbolic. The temple curtain, remember, was the separation between the Holy of Holies, so you couldn't go into the Holy of Holies. So symbolically, what Mark is saying is we have access to God. That curtain is no longer there. We can go to God. You can go to God. You can have your moment with Jesus and go to God. There was a day when you couldn't do that. There was a temple, a curtain, you couldn't go beyond. And then for the gospel writer, Mark, this is a critical point, the centurion comes to faith. He said, surely this man was the Son of God. Whatever he meant by that, he is so impressed by Jesus and how he dies that he says, surely, not just a regular soldier, the centurion in charge. He's the guy that Pilate later calls and says, is he dead? Is he dead on the cross? If he's dead, you can take him down. He's the guy. So he is saying, wow, wow, what happened here? And in Mark, he's presented as coming to faith. So the gospel has been moving towards this story all along, all along. Will we open our heart and come to faith or not? Look who's the first one who does it. Who is it? A Roman centurion. Not a religious person at all. Not one who should have gotten it. This one who has no business getting it at all. He's the one who gets it. This is a picture of Chagall's art piece called The White Crucifixion. Interesting. Chagall, a Jew, whose family knew a lot of pain and hurt, he paints this painting, The White Crucifixion. And you note the images all around, images of hurt, of pain, of fire. If you got up close, you'd see soldiers and so on. It's a picture of Christ in solidarity with you and with me. So that's what goes on Good Friday. Jesus for you, Jesus for me, Jesus in solidarity with your life, my life. He does this for us. So the picture of Good Friday, right, of course, is Christ. Christ is the one righteous person. He is the one person who actually was able somehow to live a sinless life. One righteous person. And from the Christian story, it's one righteous person who eradicates your sin and my sin. One righteous person covers your sin and my sin. It's so amazing. It is so incredible. You can see God the Father saying, yes, I finally have one human, because Christ was human, who was sinless. And it is so powerful. It can cancel your sin and my sin. And not only that, the sin of the entire planet. Of course, if we have eyes that are open, ready to receive. A good deed, right? A life lived well is very powerful. May not be sinless, but it has a big impact on everybody around. So for you, for me, can we be that? In our own way. But ultimately, Good Friday is about Christ for you and for me and what that does to the deepest core of our reality. So that for the next stage, you finally wake up. Me. Through the next phase, Easter Sunday, we will feel now, okay, this is what I'm all about. This is it. All that crap, all that stuff that got in my way that I couldn't really see clearly, it's gone. Now, and Christ will then use you in whatever new work, because it ain't ended then. Heaven is not just about going up and sitting on clouds, you know, and saying, I wish I brought a magazine to read, right? It's something powerful. There will be new work. You will be more dynamic than ever. But it all comes back to this. Will we say yes? So we return to Simon just for a moment. We saw an opportunity, but there's also the reward. And the reward is his family is also caught up in the beauty of this. And so we see Paul saying, greet Rufus, one of the sons, chosen in the Lord, and greet his mom, a mom to me also. And then at the Pentecost story, visitors from Cyrene are there, which is northern Africa. So this connection is being made. And so a moment with Jesus changed Simon's life. And honestly, I really believe that that will be true for you too. But you know, it's you and I, we have to keep saying yes, right? Keep saying yes. How do you meet Jesus? You don't meet Jesus by saying no. You need to keep saying yes. Is he going to appear? Is he going to be there in flesh? No. But he's going to show up. And you have to have eyes to see that and meet him. Otherwise, you won't. So it requires the eyes of faith. You see what I mean? Then Jesus will show up. You'll hear his words. You'll hear his voice. You'll see him. You'll respond. But it all comes through faith. We turn away in faith and our hearts start getting hard, and after a while we can't feel a thing. We do diddly squat. So it's always an open invitation. So on this Good Friday, I pray that we might say yes to God, yes to Jesus, and say, Lord, work in me. Help me to change. Help me to be what you want me to be. Look to Jesus. The great preacher Spurgeon, you've heard the story probably, out in a snowstorm. He's not a believer at that point. He walks into a little Methodist chapel. And the preacher is preaching a little sermon. The guy's a humble, you guy like me. The guy's a nobody, right? And the guy's saying, look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. And Spurgeon says, as a young guy, 17 years old, you know what? I will look to Jesus. And everything changes from that. He starts looking to Jesus. So you and I are invited to look to him. This may be your moment. We want to take it seriously, right? In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.